Hello and welcome to Dialect during BCFM's emergency schedule. I'm Tony Gosling with some thoughts on the lockdown. I suppose we could entitle this, What the BBC Won't Tell You About the Lockdown. One thing I can say is I've seen many of the issues which are coming up, particularly to do with the fight, you could call it, between various doctors and scientists who say that herd immunity is the best way to deal with viruses, in other words, bring a natural immunity in large populations rather than vaccination. I mean, those two things have been battling away for decades now, and this rather brings that whole fight to a head. We're being told by the government vaccines are the answer, not herd immunity, and well, there's many things to say about that. But what we've been subjected to is, I would describe as a news avalanche. What I'm trying to do is interpret these events in real time, based on what I've seen in the past, and through my experiences looking into stuff, being able at least to have the chance to get beyond the surface. So, the journalists now seem to be at the moment giving government and corporate announcements. They're pretty much uncritical on how dangerous this virus is. Well, they have to keep their jobs, and that's the way things have happened over the years. I mean, I believe many times I've lost my job because I'm simply saying things which the bosses, somebody somewhere, doesn't want to hear. I mean, think about stories like the death of Diana, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, 9/11, 7/7. All these have been proven to be not discussed properly, not interrogated by the mainstream press. And if you've got journalists who are trying to do that, then they won't last long. I did 3 years of training at the BBC. That was quite, I suppose, lucky, because I was absolutely determined not to compromise my principles for, you know, fear of losing my job. And we also had much worse. Terry Lloyd in Iraq, who was an ITV news reporter, Gabby Rado for Channel 4 News, both died in mysterious circumstances. Terry Lloyd was actually killed by the American army. I mean, you could suggest these people have been martyred trying to bring us, tell us the truth. These aren't just necessarily accidents. We've also had Michael Hastings in the US, who was critical of the US in Afghanistan, dying in very suspicious circumstances, driving at 80, 90 miles an hour, his car with his brake lights on, smashed into a tree and killed him. And the evening before, he'd been saying to his girlfriend his car was behaving strangely, a Mercedes. Also Gary Webb, who blew the whistle on the CIA and cocaine dealing, and you know, using the Central Intelligence Agency and the US military as a way of smuggling massive amounts of drugs into the US from South America. Anna Politkovskaya, the Russian journalist, who her death has been blamed on Putin, but she was looking into mysterious deaths of children at schools in Chechnya who seem to be being poisoned, almost as if something is being experimented on them. She reported on that. She was killed. She was executed in gangster style, basically. And I mean, that explains, doesn't it? I mean, these things like the Iraq war, the illegal Iraq war, 9/11/7/7, explains one of the reasons why much of our news media and films and drama since the 1980s and 1990s have become awful. That's the only way to describe it. I mean, certainly I feel that if I want to watch something that's worth watching, I have to watch something before that era. It's because somebody somewhere has decided that they are going to control the media, the mass media particularly. We've also had, you know, in terms of culture, we've had assassinations. People like Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison, Tupac. John Potash in the US has done a really good series of investigations into that, in his book Drugs as Weapons Against Us, and in his ongoing work. So look at the statistics in this lockdown and the coronavirus. We get 2,500 people in Britain a day dying. just that's what happens every day. So we have to compare the numbers of deaths to that normal 2,500 a day dying. That is not to diminish in any way people who are dying of this very severe flu. And remember, two winters ago, 2017, 2018, we had 50,000 extra deaths in the UK because of the severe flu that year. Some say it was vaccine failure, but there's been many, many vaccine failures, as the anti-vaxxers will point out, and I'm definitely one of them. You know, there is all sorts of ways in which vaccines have failed over the years. They are not the answer, and I would very much veer on the side of herd immunity and bringing the natural immune system. I mean, we'd virtually beaten measles when they started introducing the measles vaccine, which many people had, and then they start combining vaccines with five vaccines into newborn children all at once. Now, this is what caused Gulf War syndrome. All the people in the 1990s, early 90s, that came back from the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, very sick. These were soldiers and servicemen and women who'd been had multiple vaccines and multiple injections at the same time. This does not work. And you know, many of these drug companies, what they do is they will get approval for one as an individual, and then they will put multiple ones into you at the same time, which they've not tested for that. Also, of course, there are other chemicals in these vaccines which are poisonous, including mercury. This is a fact. Many of the vaccines still contain this. So if you want to take the vaccine option, there are many, many good surgical doctor physicians who will say this is not a good thing, and this argument is almost being swept away by this idea that, you know, oh gosh, we need a vaccine, isn't it terrible we haven't got one. Well, I mean, I have to say, I almost certainly had this COVID-19, as I know others of my friends have, the end of December. Had 3 days in bed with a high fever with loads of aspirins. I actually thought at the time, God, if I was in my 80s, this would kill me. It was a really nasty flu. And then I had a couple of weeks after that of still continuing dry cough. So I think this, personally, I think this vaccine has been around for a while. It's just suddenly been, you know, it's a very nasty flu, and it's been, sorry, not the vaccine, the virus. And it's been discovered and had particularly nasty effects in China. And of course, it's almost all elderly people who have pre-existing conditions that are dying of this. And there needs to be also a way of separating, as many doctors have pointed out, people who get very mild symptoms. They shouldn't be classed as even really having the disease, because they haven't had the symptoms. They haven't actually got ill. Anyway, even though they may be passing it around. So I think, anyway, that we're seeing also some very serious questions about the analysis of the virus. So no immunity, apparently. Is that true? If you get another flu, or which is similar, say one of the mutations of this COVID-19, I would suggest that you will be much better prepared if you've already had the previous one. And I don't really believe this whole thing of, well, actually recovering from it doesn't protect you against the virus. You can easily get reinfected. I don't really believe that, I'm afraid. And I think I've had it. And I think actually people like me who have had this COVID-19, if they're tested positive, and those tests, by the way, many of them, we're told by the Telegraph and the Express, actually had the COVID-19 contaminated into the test. And so they had to be rejected. It was discovered. They were imported from the continent into Britain. A few days ago, that story came out. That's around about the 30th of March, 2020, that these testing kits were contaminated with the virus. Now, this is horrific. And one has to wonder whether that was deliberate. I mean, how on earth could any kind of proper clinical procedure allow a testing kit to be contaminated with the virus it's supposed to be testing for? It's incredible. And it stretches the imagination to say that that was totally an accident. I mean, I think what we're looking at really is a kind of almost like a intro to World War III. I mean, we've already seen all these international tensions in the Middle East and with China, etc., and Russia, North Korea, all that stuff. And we seem to be inching towards something. I would describe this as a sort of world war conditions, but without the actual fighting war yet, although, of course, there is a lot of fighting going on around the world in places like Yemen, the West versus Iran and other and local people in Yemen, obviously, the NATO involved. And the but what is the mindset of those, these elitists in the Western world, NATO, that have been pushing these wars? Well, have a look at transhumanism. Transhumanism is seems to be their belief system, and they believe things like they want to push this whole idea of it's a technocracy, man and computer interface. So that is allowing the human nervous system to connect up with computers, that what they call the singularity. That is also the idea that that computers and artificial intelligence will take over from man. Well, not necessarily take over, but become smarter than man. They also believe in genetic engineering. They believe in human genetic engineering, and that they can actually get rid of the genes that cause death in us. So, you know, if you believe in their creed and you, you know, pay enough, your children can live forever. That's the supposed principle. And they believe, most importantly, I suppose, that man can become God. That's an incredible idea, but that's what they believe. And they don't actually believe in God. They believe man should and can become God. Well, that's likely to divide us, isn't it? I think, into those that believe this creed and those who are the workers. I mean, we've heard, you remember the book of Revelations in the Bible talks about the mark of the beast in the right hand or in the forehead. Well, I mean, you've got a division there, haven't you, between the people who are think of themselves as the thinkers and those who are the workers with it in their hand, and the thinkers and the elite with it in their head. Anyway, let's get back to World War III, because the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has put out a fascinating article, which was brought to my attention by the excellent Truth Stream Media in Texas, and their 12 Monkeys video. They did it's in the Tech Review, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, by Gideon Litchfield, and his article says, "We are not going back to normal," on the 17th of March. Very well worth having a look at. I would totally agree with the TrueStream couple on that. And what he's saying effectively there is, when the lockdown finishes in a couple of weeks' time, then the figures, as we get back to almost to normal, the figures for the virus will start going up again, and then we'll have to go into lockdown again. And he's talking about a series of lockdowns, each lasting, say, a month, with a week or a couple of weeks in between. And this will go on and on until there's a vaccine for it. And, of course, what this is doing is actually preserving the potency of this virus. With most of these viruses, many people have caught them, they aren't potent anymore because people are immune to them. But this one will be preserved through the lockdowns. And also, this has this kind of Naomi Klein shock doctrine effect. We're talking about here is moving over to, and what he talks about is going over to a digital ID. For a digital ID for those with the vaccine, who've had the vaccine, and that will allow you to use public transport, to use pubs, etc. So this is, we're talking really here about a kind of identity card, you know, the sort of thing we fought back in the noughties, the ID card battle to stop that, because of the totalitarian implications of everyone having to carry an ID card everywhere, which we don't do in Britain after the Second World War, and remember memories of that. Catherine Albrecht in the US has been talking about this sort of thing for years, the RFID chip, the digital ID chip, which then could eventually become possibly an implanted microchip, this mark of the beast thing. So the shock doctrine is well worth looking at. If you've not seen that from Naomi Klein, that's the idea, is a series of shocks, 1 month of lockdown, a little period of freedom, and then another month of lockdown. And that is like almost like kind of electric shock treatment in order to persuade you that you've got to have the digital ID, you've got to have the vaccine, and it's a kind of, you know, I don't think it will be forced on people, but I think it's going to be a system of coercion. One of the things they did here in New Zealand, for example, was that they said if you haven't had the flu vaccine, you have to wear a face mask all the time when you're in nursing homes and hospitals. Well, a lot of the staff did not believe in having the flu vaccine every year, but they managed to coerce the staff by saying you have to wear a face mask if you've not had the vaccine. And so, of course, you know, most staff don't want to be wearing a face mask all day, every day. And eventually they crumbled and had the and had the vaccine so they could not work normally. So it was a method of coercing people. And I think, you know, if you want to be able to use normal services, go back to normal, you're going to have the digital ID that proves that you've had the vaccine, and that you believe in vaccines, really. It's almost like a kind of religious belief, because the debate about the herd immunity versus vaccine has not been had. And also, what about people like me who almost certainly had this and are now immune to it, you know, because our immune system has coped with it and we've lived through it. Anyway, some of the good news. Love is more powerful than fear. And whoever is up to this, Bill Gates is a name that keeps coming up, with his ID 2020, which is this digital ID, and his exercise in November 2019 about a massive flu or virus outbreak which would kill 65 million people. Bill Gates's name is stamped all over this, I think. Bill Gates, of course, is a monopolist, Microsoft monopolist. He doesn't believe in competition. And that was Microsoft, I remember many years ago, that wrote something called the Halloween Memo, which was demand within an internal document which was leaked from Microsoft, saying that Linux and open source software was going to have to be basically strangled by all sorts of underhand means, because if open source software was allowed to develop, that Microsoft could never compete with it. And so, I mean, this is the sort of mentality there is at Microsoft. We are going to dominate the world. And, of course, they have. Interesting that he and many of the other executives have recently left their jobs, chief executives. And the economic effects of this are unbelievable. It's a power grab, very much like 2008, you know, where governments are put massively in debt, in hock to the banks, and their power is reduced massively as a result. And small businesses and medium businesses are basically destroyed. I mean, they cannot survive. They can't continue. Big business. This is big business. This is corporatism. This is fascism. Remember, it was the big German manufacturing companies like Krupps, Thyssen, etc., that funded the early days of the Nazi Party. You know, every ton of steel they sold, whatever, how many marks went to the Nazi Party. That's how they start. That's how the Nazi Party got started in the 1920s. So, you know, big corporations. The idea is there is no democracy, there is no America. There is only ITT, AT&T, Union Carbide, and Exxon, as some song goes. I'm not sure who that was. I can't remember. Anyway, I think you know what I'm saying. But anyway, love is more powerful than fear. They can't break the human spirit. They, who are they? They are, well, you could call them a new world order, but I would suggest it's P2, the Bilderbergers, effectively the Anglo-Zionist Empire. If you look at P2, I mean, then in Italy, it was revealed the whole country was being run by, you know, by people behind the scenes, by police chiefs, by newspaper owners, by the heads of the army intelligence, and bankers in Italy, and big corporations. Just, they said, well, it's our country, we run it the way we want. The government was just a front for them, effectively. And that scandal, which came out in the 80s and 90s, P2 scandal, really shows you how things work behind the scenes. That, you know, they're run by committees. Many of them, actually, that was a Masonic lodge. P2 was the top people from Freemasonry involved in that. But it's an Anglo-Zionist empire, and I think they're planning a war with China. Seems pretty clear. John Pilger's film, The Coming War with China, spells that out. And that is a kind of Orwellian, massive... World War III. Back to World War III again, aren't we? Anyway, so we need to not sell out. We need to not give in. So the idea is, you know, don't just buy into this thing and think, oh, it's okay, I'll give in and maybe everything will be all right, because it won't be in the future if you do give in. I think we need to also encourage the rights to freedom of worship and to pray. Prayer, I think, is very powerful. It's, you know, it's a spiritual thing to do. It's a belief in our maker. Because the other thing is, of course, that the, over the years with the Nazis, etc., we've seen the targeting of monotheistic faiths. Preserving human rights. Let's do that in our heart, you know. Let's try and do that, whatever you call it. That's called the jihad. Fighting the good fight, I suppose, in Christian terms. But we need to do that. And the target has been the monotheistic faith. Judaism, Islam and Christianity have all been under attack. And that is because they're all based around the Torah, the Bible, and the story, the amazing, wonderful story of the survival of the Jewish people in the Holy Land under all sorts of occupation. You know, the exiles in Egypt, the exile in Babylon, and all the lessons learned there, where God is saying, you're not doing my stuff, and I'm punishing them, and then saying, right, now have you learnt your lesson? And all of these faiths, and this is, I think, what they're being trying to destroy, is the moral imperative behind those three monotheistic faiths. I mean, you'll find Anton Chaikin brilliant on Zionism, because the, you know, these various faiths have been undermined, haven't they, through Zionism, Christianity and Judaism, fake versions basically, and also the Wahhabists in Islam. Anton Chaikin is brilliant on the creation of Zionism. And the way that works, of course, it's massively funded, as is Wahhabism, by the Saudis mainly. And his father was Jacob Chaikin, who was the strategist and the lawyer for the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany in World War II. He's well worth listening to. He really, I suppose, the whole rabbinic tradition was feeding into his father. And, you know, he's learnt a lot from all the people, the Jews in America, who were fighting Nazism and were undermined by the Zionists, who broke the boycott of Nazi Germany. So, you know, so secular Jews were used by the Nazis, and heretical Jews. I mean, that's effectively what, you know, the Zionists are, heretical Jews. So I would suggest reading books too. What we need to do, reading books. There is, okay, so Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, really important book by Paul Manning, the American journalist who was working for CBS during the war, doing reports from Europe for the radio listeners in the United States. There's also A Man Called Intrepid and The Bormann Brotherhood, both about... A Man Called Intrepid is about what was really going on behind the scenes in World War II, and The Bormann Brotherhood was really about what happened after World War II, but both brilliant books by William Stevenson, another journalist, Canadian, I think, William Stevenson was. And he was also, I think, a fighter pilot as well during the war. Those two books particularly... I mean, you know, the Martin Bormann... is talked about in the Bormann Brotherhood. It was him who was Hitler's private secretary and basically running things after Stalingrad. Well, actually, after that, but after Rudolf Hess had flown to Britain, who was persuaded to leave. That was very, very handy, because as many of Hitler's other close people, other than Bormann, they were executed during the war. People like Reinhard Heydrich and Hess, but they were just gotten rid of. And Bormann was left as the only person close to him. And as Hitler became, you know, he was losing the war and became weaker, so Bormann became stronger. He also had all the keys to all the money, the treasury, all the Swiss money squirreled away in Switzerland. So, yeah, that's William Stevenson, the Bormann Brotherhood. brilliant stuff, and Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. But above all, Op JB by Christopher Crichton, a.k.a. John Ainsworth Davis. Or maybe, no, it's John Ainsworth Davis, a.k.a. Christopher Crichton. Christopher Crichton's the book, the guy's on the title, on the cover. But don't read the reviews, read the book. It's absolutely brilliant, explaining how Churchill and his private secretary Desmond Morton and Ian Fleming and John Ainsworth Davis were all involved in this operation to get Martin Bormann out right at the very end of the war, really from under the noses of the Russians who were occupying Berlin, brought him out. And when he arrived in London, hey, guess what? All the enriched uranium that was heading off to Japan at the end of the war, after the collapse of Nazi Germany, suddenly the two Japanese officers on the submarine committed suicide or were killed, and the submarine changed course, and it's headed for the United States, delivering the enriched uranium into the Manhattan Project instead. Just the day after, that happened the day after Bormann was delivered. I think it was the 17th of May, 1945. Anyway, lots in that John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton book, Op JB. I think he subtitles it The Last Great Secret of the Second World War, and it certainly is. But anyway, what have we got to fight for? We've got to fight for our human rights, haven't we? The right to travel, assemble, worship, work. I mean, these have all gone in the blink of an eye. Temporarily, we're told, but actually, to me, it looks much more like a police state. Even an an end game, certainly a power grab. Maybe you could just sum it up as a come on, you know. This is the sort of thing that gangsters do, you know. And of course, we know there are many organized crime has absolutely got its tentacles into the city of London, the banks, and that means our buying up our politics, our political parties. Look at the state of the Labour Party. Absolutely appalling state of the Labour Party. And if you criticise the Israelis, you can just be booted out. It doesn't seem to be any proper way of, you know. Anyway, the Labour Party has been absolutely infiltrated and undermined, it seems to me. So talking about Bormann, what about the Fourth Reich? Because the successors and survivors after the Second World War, the Nazi Party, I mean, they basically turned it into an economic empire. They used $1 billion in 1945. That was a lot of money to fund massive international underground crime network in big business. It's called the Bormann Network, and Paul Manning describes it, but it's 750 companies founded by Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann. So what is this all about, this? Is it a response to Brexit, the end of the EU corporate dictatorship? Because that's what Brexit could be. I mean, it's, you know, one level, it's just Britain leaving. But on the other level, all the other countries, the people in those countries are looking at Britain and saying, wow, they left. Maybe we could leave too. So it's potentially the end of the EU's corporate dictatorship. And that is what the EU is. In fact, it's the Europäischen Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, which was a program prepared in Nazi Germany, I think it was in 1942, by the finance ministry for running the occupied Europe. As they saw it, this was going to be the Thousand Year Reich, which was going to run on and on and on. But obviously, D-Day and mainly the Russians actually, put a stop to that. This is all sort of coming to make me think that this is something much, much bigger than this. And this could even be, you know, the big one. I think if you say end game, you know, that, you know what I mean. This is the, if it's a response to, the annoyance of the Brexit has caused to the Bilderbergers. I mean, I met Bilderbergers. I know what, response, the word Brexit, was in them, which was for them to suddenly, you know, the body language told you they hate the idea. And these are the most powerful. But the people that own, I mean, like Marcus Wallenberg was one of them, and he's the most powerful banker in Sweden. I mean, he did not want Brexit to happen. And the idea that I mentioned it in front of him, well, he was fuming, basically, and extremely angry. So they didn't want this at all. And this is, I suppose, a confrontation really between the idea of democracy, the people rule by whatever means, that's a great principle, and elites.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass, remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor, and every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open, and if there is no room upon the hill, and if your head explodes with dark proposed juice, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon. The lunatic is in my head. The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade, you make the change, you rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door, throw away the key. There's someone in my head, but it's not me. And if the cloud bursts thunder in your ear, you shout and no one seems to hear. Starts playing different tunes. I'll see you on the dark side.
So if this is the real, you know, the, I mean, one of the things I've looked in over the years is the end game with the end of the world, I suppose they call it, the four horsemen. What do they mean? And these are a sign from God in revealed to John on the island of Patmos. I think it was around about 90 AD. The white horse is a leader comes forth promising to sort everything out. Obviously things are in a mess. They are. The idea, of course, of creating a mess often is to already have the solution ready. The red horse means a massive war breaks out. Black horse, I mean, this is all open to interpretation, but certainly this is the way I read it. If you pick up your Bible, you may have a different idea. Well, black horse is economic collapse, quite clearly. That, I think that's pretty obvious in the relevant chapters in Revelation. Pale horse means famine and disease. You know, don't trust me, though. I would suggest dust off your Bible, study a bit of Matthew, Daniel and Revelation and make up your own mind what these things mean. The mark of the beast is in there, isn't it? Well, isn't that maybe the microchip that we're being talked about, that Catherine Albrecht has been talking about for many years? I mean, there are also very good websites out there. I think it's called chipmenot.info, which is all about all of the adverse effects that these chips have on your cat and your dog, causing cancer and all sorts of things. So the mark of the beast, well, maybe the image of the beast, that's it all there in Revelation 2. That looks like a kind of powerful human artificial intelligence looking human looking robot in the temple in Jerusalem. Well, maybe that will be rebuilt. That certainly could be the spark for a war between Israel and Iran. That looks like the way it's going. They want to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem, which has been peacefully shared for many. It's only the oldest mosques in Islam. And they want to just demolish it and put a Jewish temple there, or Solomon's temple, rebuild it on the same spot. Well, hang on a minute. You know, surely we can move the Al-Aqsa gently and carefully or something, and they can work it out. Well, unless they just demolish it, in which case we know they want to have some sort of religious war, because that will, you know, spark something like that. What figures are there in Revelation? Well, we've got the Antichrist, a world political leader. We've got the false prophet, a high priest, a kind of, you know, devil's high priest, who is his sidekick. And then on the side of God are the two witnesses who will contest their agenda for God. So there will be some sort of debate, you know, they're going to have all their own way. So, you know, major figures are these, as I mentioned, the fake Jews, you know, the fake Christians that I would call the Zionists, the fake Muslims, the Wahhabists, and Lucifer is the rebel archangel. He is against Yahweh and Yeshua. So that's Yahweh is God's name. And in prayer, we should be using that. The Church of England seems to have taken it out of the Bible, but it's there in the Jerusalem Bible. And Yeshua, which is Jesus' name. Well, that was what he was called, you know, to his friends in his own language. So a final battle of Armageddon, that was also there, isn't it, where Jesus returns. So there's obviously some sort of war battle going on. And then there's a final battle where Jesus comes back to sort of seal the victory. The book of Daniel suggests that this will all last 7 years. I think, I mean, that's again very much open for interpretation, and that there'll be a peace treaty after. There'll be a lot of trouble, but then there'll be a peace treaty of some sort after 3.5 years. That peace treaty may break down, and then the war will really go. But I don't know. I mean, it's really, the interpretation of this is very, very open. But at least some people have tried to do it, which, I mean, I don't think you get a lot of that from the establishment church, really. So we're dealing with this modern version of what you have to call, I suppose, the Crooked Cross cult, the Crooked Cross being the swastika. So a continuation of a death cult. And you look at Vervelsburg, the headquarters of the SS, you can see exactly what they were into, which was a kind of mausoleum where they all used to secretly meet, Himmler and his chums. Kind of ancestor worship, really. I mean, we should be talking to our parents, I think, about this. Talk about grandparents or great-grandparents about what was World War II really like. I mean, we're seeing some of the measures come in again. Things like, I mean, we'll probably be seeing rationing. I mean, we're already seeing, you know, that you can't just go where you want. You need to have ID papers with you all the time, this kind of thing. That's where we're heading, it seems, with this ID 2020 that Bill Gates wants to have. So, I mean, our ancestors have been dealing with this many, many times over the centuries, and certainly over, you know, within living memory, actually. So talk to them, the grandparents, about what World War II was like, you know, the police state in those days. I think also watch dramas made by people who fought in World War II. You know, The Survivors is a brilliant one from the 1970s, that series, The Avengers, another excellent one from the 1960s, who the author Barry Wynn did the publicity for ABC Television for that. He's also a brilliant writer, was out in Malaya in the 1950s. The Man from U.N.C.L.E., another excellent series. The Saint, you know, many of us have seen bits and pieces of these, but, you know, they're brilliant. The film Dr. Strangelove, the series about the RAF in World War II, Pathfinders. There's another one, similar sort of thing, about called Secret War, about, you know, trying to get the airmen and airwomen. Oh, no, actually, I don't think there were airwomen in those days, were there? Back through Nazi Germany, Secret Routes. The Prisoner is an obvious one, where, you know, The Prisoner, who he's with Patrick McGoohan, he needs to say more about that. And the raw, tasty side of all of this is the Jason King series, I mean, with Peter Wingard, fantastic, actually. And lastly, because it does seem to have been one of the last of the decent dramas, which was a cyberpunk drama, the Max Headroom series, watch that, fantastic stuff. And this is all quite uplifting to watch. Don't forget also, though, The Lord of the Rings. J.R.R. Tolkien put a lot of stuff into that. He was one of the translators of the Jerusalem Bible, one of the Catholic Bibles, which has got loads of books in that the Protestants took out. I think, you know, that is the best Bible, really, the Jerusalem Bible that Tolkien worked on. And Tolkien put a lot of code into The Lord of the Rings. Finally, you know, we all have to decide, and I think this goes, you know, through all time, not just now, but maybe particularly now. Are we children of God, or are we products of random atoms appearing in a puddle of mud? You know, I certainly believe in intelligent design. I don't think there's any doubt. You look at the sun and the moon, they're the same size disc in the sky, exactly same. One is 93 million miles from us, another is only 250,000 miles from us, so that's 400 times further away, the sun, but they're exactly the same size. Think about it. That looks like, to me, like it's a clue in the sky. Intelligent design. The anomalous expansion of water, gas to liquid to solid, they contract, don't they? All substances, as they go from a solid to a liquid, they expand. From a liquid to a gas, they expand. No, well, not water. It expands when it goes from a liquid to a solid. Ice forms on the top, not the bottom of ponds. And my physics teacher, Martin Black, told me, well, it's because God made it that way. Jewish, by the way. And so the fish can survive when the water freezes from the top down overnight. God cares for the fish. God cares for you. Seek and ye shall find. The war is already won, by the way. The angels outnumber the demons. The Bible tells us 2-1. God favours the big battalions, says Napoleon. That's another way of putting it. The sacrifice for all your sins has already been made by Jesus Christ. Was it 32 or 33 AD on the Passover that year? Let him know you appreciate what he did. And thanks for listening.
should I be frightened of dying? There's no reason for it. You've got to go some kind.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston, St Albans and Kansas in the United States, as well as other countries. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, who are just off Jamaica Street, or online at doit.org. You can call PRSC at 0117 909 6897 or they're online at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Keep taking the high dose vitamin C in the morning and in the evening, particularly if you're elderly, in order to give your body a head start in case it gets the coronavirus or any other type of flu. So until the same time next week, God bless and goodbye for now.
Thank you.